Thank you for having me. My name is Dave, and I want to present two different levels of change today as we work together, as we get to know each other. The first is change that I need to make. We believe in the doctrine of sanctification. We are becoming like Christ. And in order to do that, we need humility to recognize that we have not yet arrived. And so throughout the first part of the presentation, I'm going to be talking about neurons that fire together are wired together. And how does that make change difficult? The second part of our time together, I'd like to talk about the emotional struggle when change happens to us. Let's begin. Neurons that fire together are wired together. I wonder if we could say that together. Neurons that fire together are wired together. Many years ago, there was a little boy who, when he should have begun to be able to speak, he was not able to. And he would go to his mommy and say something to his mommy. His brain worked well. He knew what he wanted to say. But when he tried to say it, it sounded like his mouth was full of mush. Mommy would listen intently to try to understand his heart. And she would eventually say, "Go tell daddy." And so this little boy would run and tell his daddy. And daddy would listen and say, "Go tell mommy." This little boy developed a lot of feelings. Of course, he grew up in a conservative Mennonite home, and so boys were not allowed to feel, and certainly didn't know how to talk about feelings, even if he could talk. But there were times he felt ignored, times he felt rejected and abandoned, times he felt exasperated. And the way this little boy dealt with those feelings is by temper tantrums. Stories are told of him throwing things in exasperation. Stories are told of him running into the living room, getting down on the floor, and banging his head in desperation. That stopped when mom came into the living room, the story is told, and helped him bang his head. He realized that banging head is not the way to handle it. Fortunately, though he grew up plain, his parents sent him to a public school. Very unheard of in those days. And he was diagnosed in kindergarten with a severe speech impediment. Because of the services of the public school, he was taken down the hall to begin professional speech therapy. And it was there that he learned the brain learned how to fire neurons in a way that helped his muscles and his cheek and his tongue and his lips to form words. Took 4 years of professional speech therapy. He began in kindergarten and ended in third grade. And hopefully now you're able to understand me as I speak. But one thing they did not do is they never helped me manage my emotion. You see, my brain was wired that when I felt exasperation, I could not stay in cerebral cortex. That's the largest part of our brain. And we all, today, in this moment, are in cortex. We're talking, we're listening, we're thinking. We're identifying, we're empathizing, we're in the largest part of our brain. But my brain was wired that whenever I felt ignored or disrespected or exasperated, it would go to a smaller part of my brain called the limbic system. This is the emotional decision-making part of our brain. fight, flight, freeze response. Now, after I learned how to speak, do you ever think I felt rejected? Of course. Think I ever felt exasperated? I began working with my father at the age of 12. He was a carpenter, and I worked summers for him. And I grew up as a carpenter. Angry carpenter, but carpenter no less. And when things did not go well, it was not uncommon for me to throw things. Now, why? I did not like this about myself. I knew it wasn't good. Quite honestly, I could see other people's anger, but I struggled to see my own. And it's interesting, as I get into churches, and I've gotten into a lot of churches, going to a lot of Sunday schools, a lot of the discussion on Sunday mornings when we study Scripture is about the other. Sunday mornings, in my mind, sometimes becomes the day of least change. Because it's hard to look in the mirror and see the parts of ourself that need to change. Got married, 1991, no less, June 1st. Went on our honeymoon, came back, and it was within the first 6 weeks, at least as I remember it, that my wife saw the full fledge of my limbic system. And by the way, when the limbic system of our brain is aroused, we will release a chemical that disengages the cortex. You will not be able to reason with the limbic system. You ever try to reason with a two-year-old that's having a temper tantrum? Did you ever go to limbic while trying to reason with a two-year-old that's having a temper tantrum? Now we have two limbics talking to each other. You're not going to resolve a whole lot. After I calmed down, I had my wife stand in front of me and say to me very calmly, "I do not want to have children with you until you get help." In some settings, she would have been out of line. A good submissive wife doesn't do that. But it was the best thing that happened to me. And I began a journey of rewiring my brain. Change. And I know it doesn't sound very spiritual, but whatever is going on in your life that is not Christ-like needs new pathways in your brain. Because neurons that fire together are wired together. And so how did I change? I needed to begin to recognize that I have emotion. I have feelings. And I needed to begin to put language to those feelings. I apologize. I have smart hearing aids and my phone is talking into my ear and I can't hear myself think. Talk about wiring. It may sound more spiritual to say, when you get upset, Dave, you need to pray. And you would not be wrong. Prayer stays in the cortex. You may say to me, in order to change, you need to read more scripture. You need to memorize scripture. So when you get worked up, you should be able to have scripture there. You're not wrong. But at the end of the day, my brain needed to be rewired. Every day that I go to work, and I am a marriage and family therapist, every day I go to work, I'm helping couples, individuals within that unity, rewire their brain so they can rewire their dance. For example, let's say we have a husband, case that I was working with earlier this week, husband that grew up in a home where he never saw dad initiate conversation. Dad often withdrew. So whenever there was an issue, dad would go quiet. Nobody taught him that, but he picked it up. They're in my office because when there's issues with their teenage sons, his wife approaches him and begins to, in his mind, wah, 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 wah. And he shuts down. Maybe not physiologically, but emotionally turns his back on her and he goes quiet. So as she goes quiet, she uses more words. She pursues. He gets overwhelmed. He withdraws. She pursues, and so on and so forth. They have a dance going on in their marriage. And we're not going to change that dance until we change the wiring of the brain. How do we do that? He believes she needs to change. She believes he needs to change. Nothing will change until they're able to look in the mirror and say, I am not Christ-like in this area, and I need to do something different. Their homework. I gave them homework, and I said to the wife, you may not bring this up. I'll be back tomorrow, but I'm going to ask, were you able to not mention it? And I said to the husband, you will initiate. What am I doing? You can say I'm changing their behavior. I'm changing the wiring of their brain and consequently their dance. You may not be able to do it. That's okay. But that helps me to go deeper as to what gets in the way of changing the rewiring of the brain. I want us to do an exercise. We're talking about change. And by the way, rewiring our brain is hard work. Addictions is a result of a wiring. Brain fires in a certain way, I go to my addiction. Change is hard and it's scary. We're going to look at that in scripture in just a bit. But here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to find somebody close by to you. If it's your spouse, that's okay. But you can find somebody else. And I want you to, as much as you're able, name one thing in your life that you know you need to change. And I'd like to have confidentiality. I'm not going to have anybody share, but I'd like you to share one thing in your life that you know is not sanctified. It's not Christ-like. I'd like you to name it. Let's take a couple minutes to do that. I envision churches where when we get together to study the Bible, I envision churches with people filled with humility, where they come and they're able to say, my brain works in this way, my nervous system in this way. Maybe it's because of trauma. I'm a trauma-informed counselor. I do a lot of trauma therapy, a lot around sexual trauma, working with trauma. Trauma wires the brain. It wires the whole system. And if you're going to help somebody who has been traumatized, don't give them more Bible verses to memorize. I don't mean that like some sacrilegious type of person, but we have to figure out how to do things differently in the midst of being triggered in order to fire a new pathway. I envision a church where we come together and we're able to humbly say, here's where I'm struggling. Here's where I'm not yet Christ-like. This is how I need to change. John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, is the opposite of that. The Pharisees bring a woman caught in the midst of adultery and throw them at his feet and say, she needs to change, or maybe we should stone her. What do you think? And Jesus said, I want you to look in the mirror. I want you to look at your own sin. I envision churches like that. Let's be the change that we desire. So I want to look at how changing a dance, changing the brain through a story we're given. It's a healing that takes place. It's a miracle. And we're going to sit at a woman's feet just for 5 to 10 minutes and learn from her. This woman had been bleeding for 12 years. Perhaps you remember the story. And if I understand the law of Moses, there's a part in the law of Moses that gives outline and guidelines to a woman who is on her menstruation cycle. As I understand that, whatever she would sit on would be unclean. Anyone that would touch her would be unclean until they had been purified. And so this was a time of the month that Jesus is treating with a very special way. And this woman was bleeding for 12 years. What is her name? We don't know. We don't know. And I believe there's a reason we don't know. In this story, there's another person who approaches Jesus first. A male. What is his name? Jairus. He has a name. Scripture names him. He is known. What is his title? He has a title. Synagogue leader. He's a synagogue leader. And he is somebody of importance. How does he approach Jesus? You remember?
Directly asking for action.
Directly asking for action. And so he bows down. And the picture I get there is he bows down. He has face-to-face contact, or eye-to-eye contact, rather. Looks up at Jesus and says, my daughter's in need of you. Please come. And he has confidence. He has eye contact. A lot of people I meet with who have been traumatized do not have eye contact. I was meeting with doing an intake earlier this week with a plain young lady, 16 years of age, no eye contact. By the end of the session, we had eye contact. But Jairus had eye contact. Confidence. He carried himself with confidence. He was respected. People knew who he was. He's named in Scripture. Jesus begins to go to heal him. And into the scene comes a woman with no name. She has a reputation. The woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, that's what we know about her. Now, what this would mean, think about how her brain would have been wired. Would she have wanted to be seen? More than likely not. Would she have had people wanting to hug her, to touch her? Probably not. So she comes upon the scene. How does she approach Jesus?
Stealthily. But still.
Yet. From the front, back, from behind. And she touches him with the belief that I'm going to hopefully be healed. And I believe she wanted to make her escape with as little attention as possible. This is a woman who's been traumatized. And Jesus stops. And he says, who touched me? Now his disciples kind of mock him there a little bit and say, if you see the people all around you, what are you, crazy? Everybody's touching you. And he says, now I know power is going out for me. And then in one of the Gospels, and I think it's in the NIV or maybe a New American Standard, I forget which version, one of the Gospels says he looked upon the woman. And that phrase, he looked upon the woman, is used in his interactions with women at the well, at different locations. Jesus looked upon the woman. This would have been a new experience for her. How do I know it? Because of what she felt. We'll get to that in a moment. Jesus healed her physically, but she was not yet healed emotionally, relationally, or in her community. And Jesus was not satisfied with partial healing. He looked upon the woman. And then it says, with fear and trembling. This is very important to me. Please know that whenever you rewire your brain, you will more than likely feel fear and trembling. For example, when conflict comes to your business, when conflict comes into your family, are you conflict averse? Or do you step into that space with a calm emotional presence? Or do you step into that space with enough emotional energy to shut the other person up? How do you step into conflict? How emotionally healthy am I when I step into conflict? I was 15 years of age, not yet driving. We were building a huge farm, lots of buildings, two new houses on a plot of ground up on the top of the Texture Mountain. And we had signed a contract, and we were laboring there. Drilled through ironstone to hit water, we got nothing but dust. We set up again, drilled again, got nothing but dust. This is third hole. We finally got enough to provide water for the animals. Turned in the bill to the homeowners, and they hired a lawyer and sued my dad. I was at that time very conflict averse. I had a lot of anxiety. Probably somewhat immature. And my dad had a meeting scheduled to meet with the owners and their lawyer. He was going without a lawyer. And he looked at me and he said, put your shoes on, you're coming with me. I said, no, I'm not. He said, you're coming with me. I said, I don't want to go. I had so much anxiety, I was shaking. My kneecaps were shaking as my dad was meeting with them. Now I can walk into conflict and have peace. But that took fear and trembling on my part to rewire my brain to be able to do different. You know you're changing when you have fear and trembling. And this woman, she had fear and trembling. And what does it say there? She came forth and did what? Remember? She spoke. This woman who would have wanted to be invisible found her voice in the midst of the crowd. And she did it with fear and trembling. And she told her whole story. And then Jesus gave her a title, daughter. She went from no name to daughter. And I think in that moment, she rewired her brain to no longer be silent, no longer be invisible, but be able to come forth. And she found her voice. We would do well to sit at the feet of this woman and learn from her. Many of us are crippled in ways that we do not yet even know. And change must happen in order for us to carry the light of Jesus into a broken world without preaching at them, without shaming them, but walking with them. neurons, can we say it again? Neurons that fire together are wired together. Beautiful memory. I don't want to take that away from him. Dr. Norman Doige writes that phrase in his book entitled The Brain That Changes Itself. That's from where I pulled out the book, The Brain That Changes Itself. I would like to just take a little bit of time. If anybody has any questions about changing the synapses or changing the firing of our brain in order to change, and the difficulty of that, the struggle of that, any thoughts on that, any questions you have for me before we go into looking at the emotional struggle of change.
Yeah, I have a question. Is that something that we can teach ourselves to do, or do we have to have some external help in doing that?
The question is that something we can do on our own, or do we often need to have like a coach or somebody help us with that? That's a really good question. I would just give you some examples, first of all. So this touches on my philosophy of therapy a little bit. With this 16-year-old, how did we go from, I want to talk about the help, first of all, and then I want to talk about how we can do some things on our own. So how did we go from no eye contact when she walked in the room to having eye contact by the end of the session? How did we do that? So I had her stand across the room from me, and I said, I'm sensing that you struggle with confidence and being able to find your voice. So here's what we're going to do. When you're ready, you're going to tell me to come walking towards you. And as I do, I don't want you to allow me to get close to you. I want you to tell me to stop. And so I began to walk. Now, if imagine her, 16 years old, grew up as a female in a culture that probably frowns on females having a voice. So here's this man coming towards her, and she's supposed to tell me to stop. What do you think she's feeling? Fear. Fear. Where do you think her eyes go? Where might her eyes go? Down. Stop. Great. That's wonderful. I back up. I said, that's wonderful. Glad to hear. I could barely hear it, but I'm glad you had voice. This time, as I come towards you, I don't want you to drop your eyes to the floor. Have eye contact with me the whole time and say stop. And so I did, and she was able to. Boy, that's amazing. So now we've got a new pathway going. And so I want to build on that. This time as I come towards you, I want you to say it loud so the person outside, there's nobody outside, but so that if there were somebody outside, they could hear you. And we had eye contact and volume. The last time we did it, I said, now this time I want you to have volume, eye contact, and step toward me. Stop! Say it like you mean it. And I began my walk toward her, and she was able to do it. What do you think happened to her in that process? What do you think happened? You gained confidence. She gained confidence, and she began, so it was easy to sit in the chair and have eye contact with me when she was talking with me. That is the way we help people rewire their brain. I'm constantly coming up with creative things. I have other counselors that contact me and say, here's a situation. How can I help them? I've been asked to write a book on just creative interventions, and I make them up sometimes on the spot. Sometimes they're stupid, admittedly, but we try to rewire their brain and we give them help. And here's what we do then. This is my philosophy of therapy. I do not want to be in the room one moment longer than I am needed. And so I've empowered them to continue that process of changing that brain, rewiring that brain, specifically in this young lady's life with her mother. Whenever she has conversation with her mother, they're both fighting for control, and they both get loud, and she wants me to change her mom. I refuse to change her mom. Mom's not in the room. And I'm helping her to become emotionally grounded that no matter what mom says, you can have eye contact and remain calm. And so we practice and we'll practice. And then I get out of there and have her go live for 2 weeks or so, come back, and we'll see what went well. We'll see what other creative things I can help with. But oftentimes, we might need that gentle push and then back off and say, you got this. Yeah, great question, Brian. Other thoughts or questions, sir?
Any thoughts on the generational patterns that had taught us to be wired as a way?
Yeah, so just this week, Dale, right? Dale? Yeah, Dale, I really appreciate this question. I have this couple that moved in from Montana. They're in the area for about 4 months. They want to work on some of this stuff with me. And they're living somewhere here in Lancaster County, and they travel up to Lebanon to see me. But yesterday, it was a breakthrough. This couple has had issues with church leadership. And they came initially to see me so that I can help them change church leadership. And obviously, I can't do that. And so yesterday, she began to talk about every time as a little girl we came home from church, Dad at the dinner table, or dinner table it would have been called, he would go on and on about everything negative that happened, everything negative. And then we started to think about her siblings. They're all grown now, and a lot of them have issues with church leadership, different parts of the country. And I said to her, do you think you do the same? And she said, do you think that's what my problem is? So it's never, we'll never find the root, but do you think it contributes? And so her homework was, she had complained or was hurt by 6 different aspects of church life. I put them on the board. Her homework now for this week is, I want you to write positive things about each of those 6 categories. And that includes the ministers or those that are in authority. What are your blessings on that? And she said to me, what if there aren't any? And I said, we're not in hell. So that's a generational pattern of negativity. And when they go to a new community, and they've been to a few new communities, it starts off well and then turns bad. And it's usually the minister's fault. And I'm not saying they handle that well. I'm not here to defend, but maybe there's a generational pattern that is wired and we don't even know it's there. Until yesterday, we really hadn't known that. And then it came out. Yeah. Great question. Is that helpful? Yeah. Good stuff. Any other before we jump into the second part? Yes, ma'am, in the back.
No person will need their brain rewired.
Yes, ma'am.
Would they not object? How do you help? Yeah.
When I was a carpenter, I would just go get a bigger sledgehammer. 5-pounder wasn't doing it. There was always a 10-pounder. The question is, if we have somebody who we know needs to have their brain rewired, but they do not know it or do not want to acknowledge it. Sometimes they know it, but it's too painful to acknowledge. What do we do in that case? So this is, I know we're not, I'm not here presenting on personality disorders, but quite often these individuals, ma'am, have a personality disorder. You will never convince an emotional manipulator, for example, or worst case scenario, a narcissist. You will never be able to convince them, no matter how intellectual your argument may be. You will never convince them that they need to change. So a case in point, a few weeks ago, I guess it would be a few months ago now, a gentleman and his wife came to see me. And I asked them why they're there. It's what brings you here. I don't do a whole lot of chit-chat. We jump right in. What brings you here? And he said, we have difficulty communicating. Well, that means nothing to me. And I said, what is it that you argue over? He said, well, my wife gets too hysterical when we try to talk. And I want you to help her with her hysterics. She was sitting right beside him. And I said, well, what is it? What is the topic? And he said, well, I believe the scriptures allow me to have more than one wife, and I want to add another wife to my household, and she gets hysterical every time I bring them. Can you help us? Now, you can all laugh, and I understand that. That I'm not naming that to shame any of you, but this is a very real struggle for this couple. And she begins to sob. So I ask, what does your pastor say? Well, my pastor got a PFA on me and won't let me back on his property. Okay, so we're probably looking at a personality disorder. So how do I handle that? How I handled that was begin to set boundaries. That sounds harsh. But I think Jesus made it very clear we should not be throwing pearls before swine. I'm very, very slow to call somebody a swine. But in a case like this, I encouraged her. I have trained up a network of therapists, supervised a lot of therapists, and I have some very good females who work with battered women. And so I said, with him in the room, I looked at him and I said, would you be kind enough to allow your wife to get some individual help to help her with her hysterics without you in the room? It was very intentional. I didn't need him in the room. She needs help. And she has to get to the point where she begins to set boundaries. So this is an extreme case. Perhaps, but this is a situation where he does not need help. His pastor tried to help him. He bullied the pastor until there was a PFA. And so it goes. There is no intellectual nor spiritual lesson that I'm going to do in that room, yet that's what the wife wanted me to do. She thought maybe I could change his mind. I'm not even going to try. So I set a boundary. You need individual help. And you need to also learn to set boundaries. Where that will lead, I have no idea. Not the answer maybe you wanted. Still thinking about it. Helpful? A little bit. Okay. All right. We want to go to looking at what happens to us when change comes into our life. When there's a death of a loved one, the loss of a job, the stock market crashes, the housing bubble bursts, we're out of work, we have a teenage child that is in full-blown rebellion. What happens to us emotionally? And for that, I want to go to 2 Kings chapter 2. You can follow this story. This is a story of a change in leadership between Elijah and Elisha. And I want to follow the emotions of Elisha and consequently the Israelite community as leadership changed. It was a huge loss. We're introduced there to the story. I'm just going to kind of paraphrase it and tell it. Elijah and Elisha are walking together, and Elijah says, I'm going to go on, you stay here. And Elisha says, no, I love you way too much. Wherever you go, I want to go. So they're walking along, and they get to a town, and prophets come out, and they say to Elisha, do you not know that your master is going to be taken from you today? Perhaps you remember the story. And Elisha responds, this is the first thing that we will almost always feel when we have catastrophic change happen upon us. Elisha says, yes, I know, but I don't want to talk about it. If you're taking notes, the first thing that many of us will feel when catastrophic change comes into our life is denial, shock. I get phone calls from the plain community where I'm asked to travel into a home where there has been possible suicide or farm-related accidents where there is sudden death, and I am called to go and minister to the family and to the community. And I remember stepping into the home, a 23-year-old son had committed suicide and stepped into that home, and the mother just latched onto me, and her whole body was, as you can imagine, was sobbing. And she said over and over, this is a bad dream. I'm going to wake up tomorrow and it will be different. That is shock, denial, and it is our body's response. It's an emotional response because we cannot begin to process the magnitude of what has just happened. And so we go into shock and denial. If this phase lasts and goes on, I met a woman who was in denial for about 5 years. Her son had been killed in a farm-related accident, and the bedroom, his bedroom, no one could go in. It was kind of a memorial for the son. The husband would have liked to move, to sell the house and move. There is no way you were going to drag her out of that house. And so we can be in shock and denial. It is a phase that many of us will go through, understandable, but we can get stuck there as well. So they go to the next town, and this happens at least two times, maybe three, where Elisha is greeted with the prophets, and they say, don't you know your master is going to be taken from you today? And he says, yes, I know, but I don't want to talk about it. It's very hard to force a person to talk when you're working or ministering to somebody in this kind of loss. It is best to be present, but not force them to talk. In our plainer communities, I believe a lot of people do not come out of that because they just say, well, we now need to move on. I had an adult client come to me, traumatized. One of the reasons was her four-year-old sibling was caught in a green bin accident and died. And decades ago. And after the child was buried, she remembers dad sitting at the head of the table saying, we will, if I didn't say so, it was a little girl. He said, we will not mention her name again. She is dead. She's buried, and we will not talk about it again. And so this is a form of denial, of just avoiding can be a form of denial. And I think in our more plain culture where you pull yourself up, you have cows to milk, there's not much time for tears, or at least we say that. We just go on with life. That's a form of denial. I could say a lot more on that. By and by, 2 Kings chapter 2, they're walking on and a chariot of fire comes and sweeps Elijah into the heavens. And Elisha, his next response is often what we feel when catastrophic change comes. And we don't talk about it because we believe it's wrong. And that is anger. Elisha grabs his clothes, he tears them. Puts dust on his head. He grabs the staff of Elijah. He strikes the river. And as I understand the Hebrew there, he yells, where now is the God of Elijah? As he is striking the Jordan with it. If you read towards the end of that chapter, you will see some displaced anger. Elisha is going on up to, I believe, Jerusalem, and some youth come out of the woods, kind of making fun of him. Going up, you bald-headed man, going up, you bald-headed man. And he calls down a curse on them. A bear comes out of the woods and mauls them. Anger can be really helpful for us to move through the grief that we feel when change comes on us, but it can also become dangerous. So we have to be mindful of that anger and how we are working with that. Some years ago, I had the opportunity of working with a young woman who a few months before had buried her 3-year-old son. And that's not supposed to happen. In the 1800s, 1700s, that would have happened more often. But here in the 2000s, we don't hear about that very often. And she came to see me. We had been working together. And when she sat down, she said, "You're not going to like me today." And I said, "Why is that?" And she said, "I am angry. I just came from the grocery store and I gave the person who was packing my groceries a piece of my mind. And for the life of me, I don't know why. They were doing a good job. I don't know why." I know why. Because you're going through catastrophic change. Where does this anger come from? I believe, in my personal opinion, I believe that many of us have a pseudo mentality that we're in control of our world. Most days we get up, we have a plan, we live into the plan, we end the day having successfully executed the plan. And so we develop a mentality that if we plan it, we accomplish it. Loss, change, catastrophic change reminds us we have no control, or at least little control, in the world around us. And that screams against the very nature of us who would like to have control. And we kick against that. Think about, before I go any further, I want you to think about COVID. For most of us, that's not too far in the distant past. I think we were all born during that time. We went through COVID. And nobody knew. We were all doing the best we could. The scientific evidence wasn't compiled yet. They were kind of building the plane as they were flying it. And some of those decisions we could look back on and we could argue were needed. But at the end of the day, I believe these were individuals that were trying to do the best they had or they could with the responsibility they had. That's my opinion. You don't need to agree with me. I'm pretty grown up about that. I can handle that. But how did we respond to the loss and the losses of COVID? Was there any anger?
No.
You know, I was a bishop of 13 churches over that period of time, and it wasn't uncommon for me to get an email or a phone call with somebody who had the answer. Gave me a piece of their mind. I wish they wouldn't have. It didn't seem like they had many pieces to get rid of in the first place, but they did. As a leader, you have to be able to hold that stuff and not respond or react. But there was a lot of shock and denial. The first shutdown, you realize that was just a few years ago. This time of the year, everything was shut down. People lost their jobs, lost their livelihoods. It was hard. How well did the Christian community respond? And what testimony did we give by way of hope in a Redeemer? Did we truly and fully live into the potential of that moment? That might need some of us to look in the mirror and wonder, how did we handle that? My wife, during that time, and she still is a superintendent of a public school. You think those board meetings were fun to go to? It is painful as a husband to hear your wife called a Nazi. She loves Jesus just as much as any of you, but the Christian community saw her as the enemy. It was a very painful time for me because I'm ministering to the church while watching my wife be crucified by the church. And that brought about anger in my life. And how do I handle that anger? What do I do with that? How do I move beyond that? How do I see the church? Did it change the way I see the church? This was a crisis in my journey, in my faith journey. Elisha gets across the Jordan parts, Elisha goes across, and 50 prophets come. I believe it was 50. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And they say to him, if only you would allow us to go find him and bring him back, everything will become the same. This is the middle of the process of grieving. It's the middle of the process of when catastrophic change happens to us. We often experience the bargaining phase, or as I have summarized it, if only phase. If only. If only we would have gotten one more doctor's visit or one more opinion. If only I wouldn't have had that argument with my spouse before they left and were killed. If only I would have said, I love you one more time. If only, if only, if only. And I have seen people get stuck in this phase of blaming. Sometimes we blame our spouse. If only you would have done this. We blame ourselves. If only. I've had, you know, cases are just running through my mind of people who believed at some level, if only, then the outcome would have been different. That's a lot of responsibility to carry, a lot of blame to carry. How do we move through that? We move through that by understanding that the if-only phase is us trying desperately to be in control, figure out what we did wrong and what we could do different so something bad never happens again. It's important to ask, what could I have done differently? But it will never be helpful to try to figure out what we will do that will keep bad things from happening. Bad things are going to happen. And the if only phase can be a very difficult phase to move beyond. The fourth phase that I look for, I do not see it in the story. I see it in the story of Tamar, 2 Samuel chapter 13. She moves through this. She was raped, a sexual assault, and she moves through these phases as well. And one of the phases, the fourth phase that we often experience, is depression. And boy, this is a phase we do not talk about in our plain communities. Depression. God forbid you go to church without joy. I need to preach to you. I have a client right now. She's been through trauma, childhood trauma. She's stuck in depression, and her ministers are on her, and this is more conservative than I am, but threatening her with withholding communion until she can come to church with a smile on her face, with some joy in her heart. And this is, I mean, you could put wax maybe on her face and get a smile, but this is not going to be a smile from the heart. This is depression. And people have diabetes. Who in your church gets shamed for having diabetes? Probably no one. But when it comes to depression, how does the church walk with people who have anxiety and depression that they live with? Incidentally, it is my opinion that the younger generation is going to have more anxiety and depression than the older generation. I see it in my office. I see it in extended families. And we can ask all kinds of reasons why. I have my opinions. None of them are researched. But I believe that we have a younger generation coming up where there's going to be higher levels of anxiety and higher levels of depression. This is a field of ministry. And if we come at it as, you have so much to be thankful for, put a smile on your face. Christ died for you. Yippee. We're not going to touch these people's lives, individuals' lives who are struggling with depression. And so when you're walking with somebody who's gone through catastrophic change, catastrophic loss, don't be surprised if there's a time of depression. Usually, people move through that within 6 months. If it lasts longer than that, it can become clinical depression. But usually, depression in the natural grieving process will not last longer than 6-9 months. The last phase that we go through when catastrophic change happens to us is what I call accepting the new normal. And if you are a counselor or pastoral counselor, you know that I've just gone through the five phases of grief. The five phases of grief. Denial and shock, anger, bargaining, or if only, depression, and accepting the new normal. Was Elisha like Elijah? No, he was not. Elijah was a fire and brimstone. He called down fire. He had prophets killed. Elisha, he raised an axe head out of the stream. Very different. But the Israelites came to accept him as the new normal. Wherever you have change in leadership, whether it's your business or even if it's generational business, you have a change in leadership. Change in leadership at your church, you will see people go through these levels of loss and levels of grief. And some of them cannot accept the new normal. They will not, for various reasons. So those are some of the emotional things that we experience when we go through loss and change. Thoughts, questions. Darren, how are we doing for time? We have plenty of time here. Be done in 10 minutes. 10, 15 minutes. Okay. Thoughts and questions about this process of emotional process, sir.
Well, it's putting you on the spot, but you made it sound like you, unresearched, you have a hunch that depression is a increasing thing. I would tend to agree with you on that. I also have my own hunches that are unresearched. I'm just curious if you'd be vulnerable enough to share one or two of them.
Sure, sure. If research comes out that's different. He's wondering, what are my opinions as to why maybe the younger generation is feeling more anxiety and depression? So, multiple streams. I'll pick on a few. One is that I don't know if you've watched a movie recently, but when you do, watch how quickly scenes change. Back in the day, I didn't grow up with TV, but I watched some older, like Brady Bunch, or, and you know, you had a talking scene for 30 seconds, maybe a minute. It's no longer that way. Things are flashing and changing very, very rapidly. And if you can't calm your brain to focus and think and follow, and things are changing, you have to understand what that's doing to the brain. Synapses are firing. And so it's harder. It's going to be harder for this generation. It's not their fault. I'm not faulting them. I think it's going to be harder for this generation to do calming. Their brain is going to be firing a lot. Oh my, we have a problem. And due to anxiety. So that's one. Second one is, I think we as parents have contributed to it. We have told our children that they can do anything they want. Put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything. And I work with younger people who have put their minds to things and they can't do it. But we have convinced them that if they work hard enough, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you can accomplish anything you want. It's not true. But that raises anxiety in a child when they try to do something and they're not cut out for it. But I should be able to do anything I want. So those are two things I could go on. But thank you for that question. Yeah. Ma'am. Speak to how we can help this next generation with anxiety and depression. Yeah. First and foremost, the church must look at how we view depression and be honest with ourselves. I have a family member that struggles with depression, and I am not proud of how I've handled that earlier in my life. It was pretty much, look, you need to do this. I don't care what you feel. You need to do it. Not very understanding. We have to recognize that depression is like a fog that wherever the person goes, it's the densest fog we can possibly imagine. And when we're driving through it, we can't see but 50 feet in front of our car. And we're wanting them to plan for the next semester or the next summer or the next. And the fog, they are not able. And so I've had people who have been depressed who have helped me know what it means to just sit with a person, first of all, and say, I do not understand your depression. Can you help me to understand it? And that's relational. Once we get into that fog with them and be able to begin to understand how it is for them, they can begin to trust us. So I want to back up a bit. I'm very cautious in answering this question. It's a good question, by the way. I'm very cautious in answering it because too many times in our church community, and I'm sure you are all different, so I want to celebrate that. But too many times in the church communities that I work, we want instant fixes. We want to come send a person to therapy and we're going to pay for 3 sessions. Okay, well, then what? I understand that there's limited resources, so I get that. But when we're working with this deep issues like this, this is a journey. And so that is one thing I would really love to encourage us when working with anything but anxiety and depression. Let's recognize that this is a trip rather than a destination. So get to know what their depression is like, walk with them. I'm not going to leave you nor forsake you. Those are the words of Jesus in Hebrews. Those can be our words. With this family member, I apologize for how much pressure I put, and I'm here for you. And things are getting better, but it's a journey. So I'm sure if I think a little bit more, I could come up with more ways. I think in helping this 16-year-old, she had lack of confidence, anxiety. Some of what I did with her could help along the way. And just it's a slow, slow process. Which, by the way, I have struggled. I was a carpenter. At the end of the day, I could always see what I accomplished. And when God called me to this, I never know what I accomplished. And that meant I had to rewire my brain around my identity. I used to have identity. I am what I accomplish. I am what I get done. And now I get nothing done. All day long, I get nothing done. And I go home to my parents, and my mom will always ask me, almost always, it's dangerous to say always, but I would say almost always, she asked me, what did you do today? Nothing. I don't know. I did nothing. Yeah. And so that was really a crisis of identity for me in how do I walk with people and do nothing. Other thoughts, sir, in the back?
Yeah, you talked about earlier, you know, the brain and the cortex and the limbic system. You mentioned some pull you got your way back in the cortex. Do you like the staff supervisation, the same like the mid side of things? What are the tools would you, or the processes, the thing to employ to pull people back in the cortex? Sorry. If Pharaoh wanted to teach you what.
So thank you for that question. To further clarify, if I hinted at it, I did not mean to. These emotional things that a person goes through is not limbic. It would be limbic if they would be punching a window or hurting somebody or hurting themselves. That might be limbic. But just because we go through these does not mean it's limbic. Person can be very calm and be in cortex and still have shock and denial. So I just wanted to differentiate there. But one of the physiological things that I did to help rewire my brain to keep me in cortex rather than limbic, when I'm meeting with somebody and they're really ticking me off, and narcissists do, by the way, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but they irritate me. If you were under the table, you might see me open my hands. Just this. So when the limbic is triggered, do you think your hands go like this or like that? Like this. So the limbic takes over and your brain is ready to fight or flee or freeze. And so you can go like this. And so I go like this. I'm currently working with a young lady. Plain community, sexually assaulted in the woods near her home as a little girl, 5 years old. And every time we get close to touching it, she will look down towards her vaginal area, cross-eyed, and her hands lock up. And almost, if you would know, you might think it's demon possession. It is. The first time it happened, it was kind of scary. But what I'm trying to have her do when that happens, so it's trauma trigger, is to open her hands. Open your hands. And be able to focus. Another thing, focus on the table in the room. Just look at the table. And then eventually I'll ask her, where are you? And she'll say, I'm in your office. Bring her back. So trying to remain in cortex longer so we can talk about the trauma without going to limbic. Means changing some of the ways we, this helps me. This action is cortex, not limbic. So that helps me remain calm, speaking truth, setting boundaries without losing my own stuff, I'll call it. Over here, Lynn.
Could you speak to the role of medication in
Yeah, absolutely. So Lynn is asking, can I speak to the topic of medication, and I'm so glad you brought this up, because I don't know about you folks, but I know there's stigmatism around medication in a lot of the fields that I work with, or a lot of the cultures I work with. We do not argue, again, if I can use diabetic as an example, we do not argue about medication when we're talking about diabetes. No one would say you need to pray more or you need to memorize more scripture. We say, no, take your insulin. Is it a pill form? Take it. Is it a shot? Take it. If you need more, take it. In the same way, now, we might also encourage them to change their diet, depending on if they're just eating anything. And we might encourage some behavioral changes, but we don't discourage medication. In the same way, fortunately, especially the Amish community, there is more and more acceptance to medication and changing some behavior. But I am a proponent of medication when it's needed. And I work with that and encourage that. It's simply the lack of chemicals in the brain that create the fog. And if we can take some medication and get some of that, why wouldn't we? So that's my opinion. Again, nobody here has to agree with me, but that's my opinion, sir.
You mentioned the fact that movies nowadays jump scenes and all that. Do you have any thoughts about the use of mobile devices and the TikTok beauty, all of that? What our response should be to those devices?
Yeah, so one of the ways that this is changing, at least in my, this is all my opinion, it's not research, the way this is changing relational connection among young people is that my son's generation struggles to make phone calls. You know, like call him, talk with a person. It'll be like, no, I'll text them, or I'll instant message them, or whatever all the apps are. And so it changes, and it's significantly changing the dating pool, where we do not meet people face to face. And in our one son lives in New York City. There, you don't ask a girl out face to face. You're a creep. And so a lot of things are being done through online, where you can say no to a person without having anxiety or without facing that person. And so it's changing culture. It's changing relationship. I'm not saying it's all bad. That will be yet to be determined, but it certainly is changing the way we interact in our world. I don't know if that's what you were thinking, or you want me to talk about it from another angle, but that's what immediately pops into my mind.
You were talking with the movies that it's called the anxiety, like the jumping around, not being a focus for a long period of time is increasing anxiety.
So face-to-face conversation, I think, increases anxiety. Because of all the apps. That was my peak. Yeah. Darren, how are we doing for time? I want to make sure you have enough.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Go.
You mentioned the opportunity for the church outside of sending somebody to counseling or paying for that. Is there a structural change or organizational change that could be implemented to help
more people that may not be acutely?
Yeah. So I allow, and I'm trying to bring other counselors on board. Let me back up. You have to understand that in my field, many people hold pastors and ministers suspect. My field can hold you as part of a problem. So when you send somebody, I'm not saying I'm there. I'm just saying that across the board, as I meet with therapists, as I give supervision, many of them see church leaders as getting in the way of what they want to do. I believe, and what I'm trying to help the ones that I supervise is, how do you involve the pastor? So my vision has always been to have therapy in a church setting where the pastor is right down the hall. and we can work together. If the pastor is part of the problem, I will more than willing and hopefully very lovingly tell him or her, you're part of the problem. So we can work at this together. So I think a better structure would be to find counselors that will work with you as a pastor, actually giving you, I've already listened to a pastor who said, oh, I don't think I'm needed. Let me give you some things to try before you send them to me, to empower the pulpit to work with individuals who need help. Yeah. I have too much to do, and if I can help somebody, we're all better off for it. So, but that, I wish I could help more counselors. And in some cases, I understand it. But then we need to have a face-to-face session with who we think is causing some of the problem and say, listen, this is part of the problem. I had that with a bishop. His son had been a perpetrator or a client, and he was defending his son, and so I needed to have a conversation with him about that. So, yeah, we're out of time. I'll take one more. Is that okay, Darren? One more.
Someone does realize they need a cult therapy or something along those lines. What resources or beyond resources and specific lists of places to find help? Or if you tell someone to think a doctor, what type of help, whether it is therapy, faith-based or not.
So that's a really difficult question to answer, and I'll tell you why. When people reach out to me, I'll say, I need to have a conversation with you to even know if I can help you. So sometimes people reach out to me for DNA, drug and alcohol, and I'm not a DNA. I stink at it. I'm not good at it. And so we need to know what is your need before we can say, here might be an avenue that you can try. So it's really a vague answer. I apologize, but yeah. Darren, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.